Welcome to the Gould Standard, the regular arts podcast presented by the Glenn Gould Foundation, featuring conversations with fascinating people from across the world of the arts. I'm Brian Levine, and if you like what you hear on our show, be sure to click like, share, and subscribe. And if you'd like to support the work of the Glenn Gould Foundation, go to www.glenngould.ca and make a generous donation by pressing the button. You can't miss it. Now, on to our program. Our guest today is a leading voice in an exciting new generation of Indigenous artists charting new paths in media, exploring exciting frontiers in technology, and giving fresh life to the experiences, stories, and insights of our people. Nyla Inuksuk is an Inuk filmmaker, documentarian, writer, producer, and virtual reality content creator, as well as being a successful entrepreneur. She's the founder and CEO of Mixtape VR, and is now in the final stages of production on her first feature film, Slashback. Her career encompasses music, gaming, and even the co-creation of a Marvel Comics superhero. And in the interest of full disclosure, she's a member of the board of the Glenn Gould Foundation, which makes her my boss. And that is about as good a guarantee, Nyla, of softball questions as you could possibly hope for. Now, I can't help but notice your location. You're in quarantine.
Yeah, I'm in a hotel in Ottawa, and I'm here. It's day 7 of 14. So I'm quarantining here before so that I can travel up to Nunavut, which currently has zero community-based cases of COVID-19. So we're just being very careful and the government's being very careful of allowing people to travel back into the territory. So I'm here with a small crew, and we're all quarantining in separate rooms, but together in the hotel. And we're going up to just finish filming Slashback, which is this feature film of mine. And we were supposed to go and finish it at the end of March. And then, of course, the world kind of shut down, and we were waiting for things to open up. And then we realized that that probably wasn't going to happen anytime soon. So this is the solution, is quarantining and then heading up.
That's something that the people who you worked with on the first budget for your film probably weren't taking into account.
Yeah, no, not at all. And the thing is, it's not like they can be working while they're in here. So we're all trying to figure out things to do to keep busy. And there's one little street behind the hotel that they've cordoned off from traffic, so we can go out there and walk back and forth on this street. So that's been our exercise and also our social space.
I'll bet you some people are getting to new levels in their video games that they hadn't gotten to before.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So going to Nunavut, now our audience is worldwide, and some people who watch this may not actually be familiar with Nunavut. So can you tell us a little bit about it? You were born in Iqaluit and you were raised in Iqaluit, both of which are in Nunavut. But can you paint us a picture of Nunavut as it was when you were growing up, and also the communities that you're filming in today?
Yeah. When I was born, it was actually the NWT, Northwest Territories. But of course, Nunavut is in the eastern part of the Arctic. So that it became its own territory in 1999. And so but it's in essentially Canada's high Arctic. And so Iqaluit, the community I was born in, is one of these really tiny communities that was really only created in the last 70 years or so. And it has a population of about 1,500 people. And there are these little communities throughout Nunavut. And then Iqaluit is the capital city with big city, 7,500 people. And it has it because it is its own territory, has its own government and all of those things. So it is has a little bit more of an infrastructure.
Right.
But we're actually going to film in one of the communities called Pang. It's really this tiny place, but in the middle of these beautiful, gigantic Arctic fjords. So tons of mountains, and it's absolutely stunning. It's where my nephews are from, and I am in love with this place. So when I had this idea for Slashback, which is about these girls from Nunavut who take on this kind of alien invasion, I knew that to set it up in Pang would be really amazing for a couple of reasons. One, because it is just so stunning and beautiful. But also the girls from there are really tough and cool.
That's amazing. So you grew up in a very small place, but also a very big place because, and by the way, I encourage everyone, get out a map or Google and take a look at Nunavut. It's gigantic. It's huge. It encompasses Baffin Island and all the area around the northern part of Hudson's Bay. In fact, I think I read that it is the fifth largest subnational landmass in the world. So lots of space and few people. What kinds of communities and community life did you experience when you were a little girl growing up?
It is one of these places that is these kind of small communities where everyone knows everybody. Certainly when I go home to visit my parents in Nunavut, if I don't let anyone know, I get to the airport, and by the time I'm at my parents' place, people are calling and it's, oh, my cousin saw you at the airport. And so everybody knows what's going on. And it's this bit of a small town feel, but community is a big kind of part of just living in the Arctic. And yeah, it's amazing. This community of Pang that we're going back to, myself and my crew, we're all just so excited because we spent the summer there last year. And it was really amazing just to spend, you know, 3 or 4 months in this one place, getting to know the community and really living and working there. And yeah, so we're all so excited to go back and see it in the wintertime as well, because we shot in the summer, which is when there's essentially 24-hour sunlight. And so now we're going up and the daylight is decreasing by 20 minutes a day. It's quite drastic.
And when you describe the communities, this isn't like what we experience in Toronto, where there's another town 20 minutes down the road. These are communities that are quite far apart.
Yeah, they're fly-in communities only. And even Iqaluit, which is the capital, you can only access it by air. And so there is a road at that is called the Road to Nowhere, because at one point it does just end.
Uh-huh.
And there are ways you can boat to Pang if you have a couple of days. But yeah, to get to these different places, it is quite difficult. And it's also really expensive.
It must feel very intimate doing a project with your extended family.
Yeah. And the community has just been such a big part of the process. One thing that we realized really early on was that there was no way we could go and film in a place like Pang if the whole town didn't get behind us.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons was there's a housing crisis in the Arctic, and there just wasn't enough homes for the people that live in the town, let alone us to bring in 50, 60 people. We got there, and once we decided, absolutely, this has to be the place we film, I went to the principals at the high school and the public school. And they essentially let us, from the weekend the teachers leave to the weekend they get back, we could have access to the schools and the kitchens and the showers. So we actually sent up 55 beds and mattresses to Pang and set up in all of the classrooms, little kind of apartment suites with 2 beds per classroom. And our crew was rooming with each other in these makeshift spaces. It was absolutely bonkers, unlike any other film shoot, I'm sure. But it really wouldn't have been possible if we didn't have that access to that.
That's incredible. So you've got a crew of between 50 and 60, all of the cameras, the lights, costumes, scenic elements, all of that had to travel up too, right?
Yeah, a lot of the production designer really wanted to make sure that everything made sense for what was there. So we tried to source a lot of this stuff from the community itself. A lot of the wardrobe we tried to buy up there or get from people's wardrobe. We also had, like, for the lead character's house, it was just an empty house that we happened to get access to. But our production designer went around to, and she had this big ledger and knew exactly where all the pillowcases and doilies and everything was coming from. And she was borrowing from everybody in the whole town and borrowing and renting and filling up this space so it looked like a real home. And so it was things like that, trying to invest in the community where we could and also hire sewers for things like curtains and stuff like that. Wow. So it was, yeah, it's like trying to. We also, when it comes to something that like a hunter is, if we have a scene with a hunter, everything that we would want to use, it doesn't make sense if it's not already in Pang for us to be using it. So that was a guiding principle for us.
Do they have a place for you to screen? Because I have to imagine that one of the first screenings is going to be in Pang, right?
Yeah, we can't wait to get up there. And it's going to have to be the high school, of course, the high school or the community hall, but we still have to finish it. But then, yeah, of course, Pang will be, it will be great to have a screening there. And then a lot of our talent, the actors are from Iqaluit and they're teenage actors and all of their friends are in Iqaluit. So it would also be great to show it off there, especially because I think a bunch of their friends know they've all left for the summer to do this school project, but it'd be kind of neat to show everyone.
Amazing. Now, going back to your roots and origins, it, from what I know, there is a lot of art and storytelling in your family, and your mother is an award-winning artist. Tell us a little bit about how you got rooted in the idea of becoming an artist yourself.
It's really funny. I think because I had parents that were artists, I was thinking maybe I shouldn't do that. But certainly I grew up with music around everywhere, and both my parents were musicians and my dad is a recording engineer. And I of course was obsessed with movies and horror movies and that sort of thing, being a bit of a nerd growing up. And yeah, it was when my older brother, actually, he also was like a horror fan, and I just thought he was the coolest. So whatever he was interested in, I was into. But at one point, when he was in high school, he broke his leg, and he was a snowboarder and a skateboarder. And so my parents felt really badly that he wasn't able to do anything with his friends. So they got him like this kind of handycam that he could make these like skate videos with. But yeah, and then it just became something I would borrow and start borrowing my cousins and make them dress up as ghosts and film these little horror movies and things like that. So it was just a lot of fun. I really liked school and thought maybe I would study psychology or something like that. But I knew I really loved movies. And so it was this a bit of a dilemma for me, but I think in the end, I made the right choice by deciding to go to film school. And my mom, she did tell me when she was driving me there, she said, "You just have to promise to make the scariest movie I've ever seen."
She may have her wish fulfilled with Slashback, but that's really interesting that you were drawn to horror and fantasy and otherworldly creatures, because in a way that connects a little bit to traditional culture. There are spirits everywhere, and there are stories about creatures from nature, and that really must have struck a resonant chord with you as you were exposed to monsters and slashers and all the things in horror films from the South.
Yeah, I think that it's funny, within Inuit culture, there's a couple of different like ways that stories are used to incite fear, but then also laughter. And there's lots of like games that surround laughter, but even the laughter games, some of them can involve like terrifying people until they laugh too much, but it's chasing people around dressed as monsters and things like that. There's lots and lots of myth and legends within Inuit culture that are essentially cautionary tales, that you tell children, the Arctic being just an extremely dangerous place with lots of different kinds of dangers. I think that the stories are just equally terrifying because there seems to be for everything a little kind of story that goes along with it that involves a creature or a monster that if you do something wrong, then there will be consequences. And
right. And
it's really been one of my best friends. She's First Nations, so another kind of Indigenous person from Canada. But it was someone asked both of us about what Northern Lights meant to our communities. Mm-hmm. And it was really funny listening to her describe this really beautiful idea about people that have passed away and their spirits in the sky. And then I was just like, where I come from, the Northern Lights are, you're out alone at night. They'll chop off your head and then play soccer with your skull. So it was just a very different kind of take on this same thing. But it was the underlying thing is don't go out late at night. So there's plenty of different myths that involve not getting too close to the cracks in the ice or leaving your tools unattended and that sort of thing.
Because you grew up in a place where, you know, for us, the distance to go down the block and pick up some milk, if it's the coldest part of the year and there's a storm and you go that distance and get disoriented, you're dead.
Yeah, it is a really dangerous, it can be a really dangerous place. And even when we are going up and filming, we're always, if we're filming away from the communities, we have someone that's with us that has a rifle and is, you know, understands these kinds of dangers.
Like polar bears.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something that you don't encounter on most everyday film shoots.
Yeah, exactly.
So you came down to the South and enrolled in film school and you studied at Ryerson. How did that lead into your first experiences actually making short films of your own?
Yeah, I've been making some short films just on my own when I was in high school, but it was wonderful going to Ryerson because we really just, certainly by our final year, we're just making movies. I had a bit of a focus in producing. That's, I like the logistical kind of organizing of things. And so that was something that I was really into, and also writing. And so it was just a wonderful place to actually just explore. And it's funny, I'm here in this hotel. There's two of my classmates from Ryerson are here with me because one of my producers and my DOP, the camera person, are classmates of mine. So we still work together, and that is actually the greatest benefit of being there, is really forming these relationships. And this is when we figure out how to collaborate with each other and tell stories. And so it was a really fun and experimental time. And Tipper, who's my DOP that's coming up for Slashback this leg of the shoot, she's been up to Nunavut a couple of times with me while we were still at university to film. We filmed a documentary with some of my former classmates from in Nunavut, and then we also filmed the year after film school, or maybe it was 2 years after, we made a short film called Kayuchayuk that was a horror film and a lot of fun.
Now, at a certain point after you graduated, you began doing some work with the National Film Board. Tell our audience what the National Film Board is like today. Older folks like me, we remember seeing little documentaries in the classroom that were often from the NFB, as well as some, you know, crazy animations by people like Norman McLaren and all sorts of sort of public interest films and videos. But it's really emerged now into being an incubator for a lot of independent talent. And so how did you come in contact with them, and how did that relationship develop?
They had a program that was called, Stories from Our Land. And it was, and so they were producing short documentaries, and it included a bunch of workshops. I went up to Nunavut as part of this program. And I met with a few producers from their Western Canada office, which is based in Edmonton. And so that office oversees anything from Western Canada and Northern Canada. And so it was just a week of workshops. And then we could also, as we were split into groups, and then we were asked to pitch ideas for documentaries and then make them within a couple of days. And so then we shot and recorded sound and edited as a group. And it was a really fun experience. It was this similar kind of thing that you would in a condensed kind of version that I might have been doing at film school, but this was just amongst other Inuit. And it was really fun. We made a documentary about this, actually a real life superhero. I'm not sure if you know what those are. They're like people that dress up as like superheroes and then try and help out around their community. And he's based in Halloween and he helps stop bullies and shovel snow. He's a real character who goes by Polar Man. And so we made this little documentary about Polar Man, and it was a really fun experience. And that's how I met a few of the other producers at the NFB. And so then from there, I think there was a second kind of part extension of that program that I was a part of. And the NFB does this kind of these kinds of things pretty regularly. And if anyone who's listening is interested in that sort of thing and is from Canada, checking out, there are different NFB studios around the country. So there's one in Montreal, Edmonton, Vancouver, Toronto. I'm sure there's an East Coast one, but they all make documentaries and animation and really wonderful, wonderful works. And they've really recently made authentic representation and stories by Indigenous people a priority for them. And so there's often training opportunities and things like that. And so that was a kind of a nice way for me to be introduced to the NFB. And then I ended up after those doing those programs and meeting people there, doing my own stuff with them as well.
One of the projects, I can't remember whether it was part of Stories from Our Land, but you did a film with the Inuit accordionist, Simeone Kinaikak.
Yeah, Simeone Kinaikak.
It's a beautiful film. But music has been a big part of your work, too. You've worked with A Tribe Called Red. You did a tribute video for the Governor General's Performing Arts Awards on Susan Aglukkaq. And you've worked with Tanya Tagak. And it really seems as though that's a thread that, first of all, is a huge area of revival expression in Inuit culture, but also something that draws a lot of people from the community together. Do you see that as something you're going to be pursuing more in the future?
Yeah, I love working with different musicians and the sound design process of kind of any of the stuff that I work on is really one of my favorite parts. And certainly working in interactive sound is something that is, I think, such an interesting format to explore, because when it comes to these interactive or virtual or augmented realities, what we're really trying to do is create the sense of presence. And sound has just a way of doing that. And certainly, and playing around with things like interactive sound, binaural sound, and all of those things are really fun. And yeah, I've always, with the Simeone piece, that was just, it's always been, music is obviously just an important part of any community, but it's also a way of bringing people together. And that documentary was the first time I actually went to Peng, which is where Simeone, the accordionist, is from. And the reason why I wanted to visit was because there are these little pockets of the Arctic where square dancing and accordion music and the fiddle is considered tradition almost. Mm-hmm. And that in the 1800s, the whalers from Scotland would stop in these little communities and would often leave instruments in these little sheds by the water so that they would essentially just have instruments if they wanted to stop by. But then they also taught these dances and these songs. And so these are things that are very much alive and well in the communities. So when I went to Peng, it was just me and a producer from the NFB. And we knew that this kind of thing had to be organized on the ground there. It's, you can't just call in and try and talk to people and get... So we were, Simeone, who's this just amazing accordion player, we organized a square dance at the community hall there, and he played, and 50 people showed up, and everybody knew all the dances, and it was really wonderful. And that's where I fell in love with Peng, actually. And then I also just have some friends of mine that are just happen to be amazing musicians, with A Tribe Called Red being a really, both of those guys, Tim and Bear from Tribe, are good friends of mine, but also just creative collaborators at this point, because we've worked with each other a few times, and they're composing the score for Slashback, the first time they've ever composed an original score for film or anything. So it's a really fun process because none of us have done it before. And so it's been wonderful. Kind of, we worked for a bit on some of their music videos, and now they're helping me out on my project.
Great.
And the first kind of video project we did work together on was this 360 VR experience. And you can, there is a way to see it online in a less kind of immersive version, where we use stereo audio and then binaural audio if you're watching on Facebook with the Facebook video player. But if you're watching it in a VR headset, the video is, there's this group of dancers that are surrounding you. It's a bit of a dance battle between these powwow dancers on one side, and then there's these like b-boys and b-girls on the other. And if you're looking at the b-boys, then you hear more of the kind of like hip-hop elements of the track, and then more clearly. And then if you're looking at the powwow dancers, then it will actually transition, and you'll hear more of this powwow kind of song coming through. And so it really came out of Bear kind of just being curious about what would it look like if you could be controlling your sound based on your gaze, and is that possible? And then just playing around with that idea, and then what that would look like. So it's just one of these things where you come up with the idea first and then try and figure out the technology to see if it will, if it's possible. And it was a really kind of fun experience.
You touched on the magic word that I wanted to explore a little bit, which is virtual reality. And that is a big part of your creative life. And in my experience, there are two groups of people who are totally into the entire VR or AR augmented reality experience, who know it well, and then people who have heard about it but really have no idea what it's like, have never had one of the headsets on their heads. I've explained to friends it's like surround sound for your eyes, but that doesn't really quite do it. And it's still a very early field. It must feel almost like being at the early days of cinema, like when Georges Méliès discovered the jump cut and he could basically make one character turn into a pumpkin or a goblin or something like that.
When it comes to this kind of virtual reality, augmented reality, mixed reality, this is all came out of the same place. VR kind of started first with the development of the Oculus. At the time, it was there, they had released this developer kit called the DK2, and it was the Oculus development kit. And that's how I got introduced. And it was through the indie gaming scene in Toronto, some people had access to this Oculus and this developer kit, and were making essentially video games using these headsets. And then also at the same time, people were figuring out welding cameras into a ball of cameras and then filming 360 video, which then was put into these Oculus headsets, and building thick synthetic environments and worlds within that you can explore within an Oculus headset. And so as this technology was developing, it was this exciting time because no one had ever seen anything like it. And everything is developing so quickly. You were just able to have an idea and do something for the first time it had ever been done, which was just, it was a really fun exploratory space. It still is, which is why I love it. And it reminds me of those days when I was like in high school and just figuring out how to use my brother's camera and then plugging it into my computer and then figuring out editing. And you feel like you're inventing this as you're going along. And you're right that it's really hard to describe exactly what it is. But also when I first got into VR around 2015 or so, which is when these kind of developer kits were coming out, it was really exciting because you could essentially go to potential clients and just put this thing on their head. And just that would be like, oh, wow, they would think this is like the future of movies or something. Because they hadn't experienced yet, it was just this really exciting time. And everybody is making stuff, and the So we get a lot of public funding in Canada to make media stuff. And they opened up the grant applications to include VR and AR experiences and that sort of thing, which is fantastic. And I think really important in a country like Canada to be also supporting technological development like this that can be quite artistic. And there really are a lot of ways to utilize this technology outside of just video games. And even beyond that, just very practical reasons and practical applications to things like augmented reality, which is essentially the layering of virtual assets onto just the real world. So unlike with virtual reality, where you're putting on a headset that makes you blind to the outside world, you can only see this virtual world. Whereas augmented reality, you're seeing the regular world. Perhaps you're just seeing it through your phone or you're wearing a pair of augmented reality goggles, but there's like an augmentation to the environment around you. And actually we've spoken about this, but even there's that company that was using some of these technologies to recreate even Gould's performance of piano and provide the experience of what it would be like to be listening to Gould as Gould with his ears distanced a certain distance from his head, like how it would be for him to be listening to himself play the piano if he was, you know, standing 10 feet away from it. These kind of like bizarre, bizarre kind of things that can utilize these technologies and in a kind of weird and crazy way.
It sounds like the sky's the limit, but I guess a lot of people, particularly the people who control the big purse strings in media companies, want to know, how do we monetize this and how do we turn it into a mass experience? And I guess the experience with the revival of 3D provides some cautionary tales, because I can't remember how many years it is now when they started bringing the 3D back into movie theaters. So we had this very exciting moment for 3D where, in addition to large-scale blockbusters and CGI animations, we had serious directors like Wim Wenders and Scorsese and others experimenting with the medium, but virtually every one of them did one film, and it seemed to be a been there, done that, now I can move back to doing what I normally do. And I guess people are wondering, can they imagine in the future VR feature films in theaters equipped with the headsets? Do you see that as part of the future development for the medium?
I don't know. I think that probably not. Because I think that there might be these kind of virtual reality theater experiences perhaps, but I think that the VR as a medium does have to be thought of as its own form of media. And just if you were to take the same story and tell it as a radio drama, you would tell it differently and use different kinds of tools as then you would if you were to make it a series, and then if you were to make it a feature film. And I think that kind of thinking about it in that way, it is a much more interactive experience. Volumetric capture actually would have an array of cameras that all shoot inwards on action, and so that you would be seeing from every dimension, perhaps actors as they're going through this fight scene. And then essentially you could rebuild that digitally. And then you as a viewer could really walk through that scene and walk right up to the actors, walk around them. But then again, it's like with that, you really have to then be thinking about the format and do you want to be experiencing a movie that way? And then instead, it's if you're in this experience and you've got a headset on, the viewer is almost taking on a character themselves. Unlike when you're just watching a movie and you're seeing the action play out, when you're in a VR experience, you ask, who am I? Like, where am I? And that's the kind of thing you want to take advantage of when you're in these kind of new mediums. And the monetization factor is a huge thing on how these are going to be developed. The pandemic, for instance, has meant that the Oculus Quest, which is the kind of the most recent headset from Oculus that made the original DK2, which you had to strap on and have connected to a very specific gaming type of computer. It was really so very inaccessible. Yeah. The Oculus Quest now is relatively reasonably priced and It's a standalone headset, meaning it doesn't require a mobile phone to be put inside of it, and it doesn't require a gaming console or anything like that. There are experiences that are making a lot of money on Oculus Quest, including Beat Saber, which is a very popular game, but that essentially combines like hitting certain things in time to music. And that was developed by, you know, two people for essentially no money and in very little time. And that's wildly popular and commercially successful game. So there are ways to monetize, but you do have to be thinking about, okay, what is the market ready for? And certainly like when it comes to features and that kind of thing, it is a hard sell. It's really hard. And so that's why even for things like this project that we've been discussing with the Winnipeg Art Gallery, the benefit of an installation for these kinds of things is then you're not dependent on people going out and buying this hardware that is actually really inaccessible, or maybe they don't know how to use it, or it's expensive. And this means that you're guaranteeing eyes on it if you know that this is that people are going to be coming through this public space. Now, of course, the pandemic is just like changes everything. It means that those kinds of things right now in 2020 don't make a lot of sense either.
And I can only imagine that literally every month you're hearing about new technology, new gear, new things coming online, which opens up yet more creative possibilities. But one of the things that I think you've already referenced, which is to make the experience truly immersive, you need immersive sound. And you've been doing a lot of work in how to capture sound, mix and manipulate sound in order to really change the perspectives, to really mate with the visual element. Has that been a big learning experience for you? A lot of time in the studio and seeing how different phasing effects and so on can really change people's perception of their oral reality?
Yeah, it really is kind of one of the, when I was getting into this kind of immersive technologies, I was introduced to this, it was just this stereo mix kind of thing that I found on YouTube, and anyone can go and find it. I think it's called the Barbershop 360 or something. And it is essentially, they're giving you a virtual haircut, but you're supposed to wear it with headphones and close your eyes, essentially, because this is just an auditory experience. But it feels like there's someone in the room with you and that he's talking to you, he's walking away, and he comes up closer to you. He's touching your hair, and he starts like snipping, and it really does raise the hair on your neck, and it's very strange to listen to this and feel as if feel the presence of this person. This is something that was made 20 years ago and uploaded to YouTube. This is not some like new technology. And so then that really made me aware of, oh, this is such an powerful part of creating the sense of presence. And then when it does come to the limits of technology, or maybe it's certain things might be too much to render, if you have the sound figured out and you can just give some small visual cues or references, that can actually be enough. And then also I've also worked producing other artists' stuff. Like, so I've worked with Kent Monkman and the filmmaker Danis Goulet and Zoe Hopkins, another filmmaker, on creating their own kind of interactive works. And it has been interesting for someone like Danis Goulet, who's a traditional 2D filmmaker. She's just used to, there's certain kind of things that you're able to use as a filmmaker that can manipulate the viewer in a way that you want. So it is, and that might mean just like, we want you to be focusing on this. Mm-hmm. And so there's like subtleties. You can be someone who could be saying one thing, but you're seeing something else, or maybe or even just like the idea of the close-up. But when you're in virtual reality, you can see anything. And it's actually up to the viewer what they do in that space. And you want to encourage that. You want to have them be exploring the environment, and that the story kind of unfolds naturally. And it feels as if, you know, that it should feel like magic. But for someone who is, no, I actually just want them to be looking up at those geese that are flying by. And because that's like a really important to this scene, then that's where things like sound designer can be really beneficial, and it doesn't rely on these kind of heavy-handed techniques, but like having a character being like, hey, look over there. And so it's just the ways in which you can use sound to draw attention to things, and it, when you know you don't have the same kind of toolkit.
During my time in the recording industry, I looked a lot into the history of stereophony and learned that our auditory directional sense is probably our most keenly developed sense because we needed it in the early days to survive. How is it that you can determine within about 1 degree of precision where the animal that's stalking you and wants to make you into dinner is approaching from? And it is really more than just the ears. It's also the shape of your ear pinnae that helps to shape the sound. And then, of course, it's that thing stuck between the ears, your brain, that basically turns that into... But it also creates a huge opportunity for us to play tricks on it. And that's basically what you do. That's the magic part.
Yeah, yeah. And it's really funny, actually. Some of the binaural... There's a very popular binaural microphone that was released specifically for to record kind of these VR experiences. And... it's there are two ears on either side of this like little square device, but and it was specifically because the shape of the ear is actually perfectly designed to capture sound. So it's they've incorporated that into their design.
So now in the middle of all this, you are preparing your first feature film. You've got a body of short films. You're working with some of the most exciting musicians in the world today. And you have an enormous life-threatening health crisis.
Yeah. I got very sick in 2016 that I found out. And you're right, I was actually preparing to pitch Slashback at TIFF. And I was actually just going to be writing and producing it. I wasn't directing it at this point. And then my doctors told me I had a 50-50 chance of surviving the month.
The month, not the year.
Yes. And that I needed to get a liver transplant. And it would take months and months to get this. So it was this kind of really terrifying time, like the kind of the worst news you could get. And I was working a lot. Work was a high priority for me, working in these kind of new technologies. There's often this kind of like intensity around it. And especially when it's like, when you do have the opportunity to maybe be the first to do something, it's you're like then I guess I should be. And then you feel like, oh, then I have to be moving at this speed. And then I was also pitching Slashback and so it was, and I was working at this company at the time. I was an owner at a company at the time called Pinghua. And I was just having it was a really difficult time working at that organization. I feel like I hadn't understood my value yet. It sounds weird to say. And then I found out I was dying. And it was all of these things that I had really been really stressed out about and thought that were so important, I realized just none of it mattered. So something like that really does change your life. And it was a really kind of special time for me to have all of these things that you've built up your whole life thinking are really important to you. And then having all of that weight lifted, it was a really, I think, a really beautiful time for me. And I was really grateful for the experience. And I think that's really what kind of got me through is this kind of gratitude for not only getting sick, but then of course, eventually having a transplant and getting better and going through this whole thing and having that moment of realization and clarity when I don't know if I necessarily would have gotten it otherwise. So I quit the job at Pinghua a couple of months before my transplant surgery. I was developing this story about these Inuit girls fighting aliens. And I also realized that was my story to tell and not really anyone else's. And after my transplant, I went on a trip with a couple of my buddies. It was that there, I found out that there was going to be this total eclipse that was happening almost 3 months to the day after my transplant. And it was going to be this eclipse seen across the United States. So I just decided I really wanted to go. And my doctor said that I might be able to fly after 3 months. Timing was right. And so I went with one of my friends, Dan Beckerman, and also Bear, who's one of the DJs in a tribe called Red, Aaron Thomas. And we went to Portland and we went and saw the eclipse. It was this crazy, both of them are very kind of busy people and they didn't have the time, but we went for 3 days and saw this eclipse. And Dan ended up producing Slashback. Bear kind of came on to compose the music with Tim. And so it was just like, it was a very kind of, it made a lot of sense. And it was, yeah, it was just one of these projects also that I think helped me get better in a way. Yeah, but it was a crazy time. And sometimes I am still, I stop and I'm amazed that it all happened. I think that sometimes when you go through something like this, I can see myself almost and feel almost just sadness for that person. It almost feels like someone else that I'm grieving for. And yeah, so it's been a kind of this really wonderful experience and something that I'm really grateful to have gone through.
Yeah. A huge life crisis like that can be so incredibly clarifying in terms of your values about why you do what you do. But also, I don't have to tell you, in your professional life, there are a lot of professional friends which you discover are based on what you can do for them. You find out who the people are who really love and care about you, who are really the centerpieces in your life. And in a way, the things that you need to be doing and want to be doing versus the things that used to seem important before you looked at the possibility of the road falling away underneath you.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And also that I think, yeah, it was just, it really was wonderful to the amount of support, of course. And you do really realize how lucky you are, almost like a cleansing. Yeah. Elimination of things. And yeah, but then also realizing that there was also just wonderful.
And from what you've told me, you're well now, the surgery was successful, the crisis is long past, and you're with us for the long haul, knock on whatever this phony wood is underneath my knuckles.
Yeah.
So that's fantastic.
I'm the human body and also science is incredible. It's what you are able to, because it is this kind of obviously an emotional journey, but I do have someone else's liver in my body now. I've got someone else's organ, and it's when you go through this whole something like this, it can be a bit lonely, feeling like no one really understands what you're going through. And then it was a couple months in, and this realization that, oh, I've actually got this like buddy with me. It was nice to feel like, because it's amazing. It's been 3.5 years since my transplant, and I take immunosuppressants, but really that's just because I'm very healthy. And so I just have to take a bunch of immunosuppressants to just make sure that I don't reject my new organ. But other than that, everything's really good.
That's great. This may sound a little strange, but do you ever feel like you have a responsibility to your donor to look after yourself, stay healthy, not work too late, stay away from?
Yeah, I think that certain things like, but what's actually amazing is that through the Trillium Foundation, you can actually communicate with the family of the donor if they choose. And so a family member from my donor's family reached out to me and has shared some information about him. I've heard he loves ice cream. So it's really funny that the liver is a digestive organ. And so some people don't realize this, but if you have a transplant of a digestive organ, you can take on some of the cravings of the other person. And it's so funny because I was always someone that loved like savory foods, dessert I could take or leave. And then as soon as I had my transplant, I just like everything like cakes and gelato and things like that, I just was loving. And then when I found out that my donor had ice cream every day, I was just, okay, that might might explain it.
That feels like a whole new meaning to two-spirited.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I'll bet you that they're very proud of you, knowing about your work and what you're achieving. So, Nyla, you did mention Pingua, and that was through Pingua that I first met you. But it was an interesting company because you were combining language learning with gaming, and for the project of helping to keep the Inuk language alive. Can you tell me a little bit about that and what that preservation of language and culture means to you?
So when I joined Pingua, which was an organization that already existed, it was a technology company with the Inuktitut name Pingua, which means play in Inuktitut. And the idea behind the company was to tell stories that, you know, for underrepresented voices, and in this case, Indigenous and Inuit voices. Part of the work that Pingua did was these workshops in the Arctic, but also this language learning game called Singuistics, and it was essentially learning language through song. And certainly I felt that there was a really important kind of need for these kinds of things to exist, for Inuit songs and music and language to be shared and also just available. I have nephews who are 4 and 6 years old, and they just consume stuff all the time. And if we could have stuff that can also be an Inuktitut, it would just be fantastic. And especially when it comes to things like books and video games and comic books and things that young people are really going to be drawn towards, to have some representation within that, I think is really valuable. I really loved that element of the work.
And that must be meaningful, because do you speak the language at all yourself?
I've got a few words and that I can communicate, but it's being separated from the Arctic and for there's so many people, especially in Iqaluit, that just don't have access to that kind of knowledge. And so to be able to provide even these fun ways to learn, to pick up a bit of the language, I think is really valuable, especially because I think that when you're trying to learn a new language, sometimes there's worry of saying the wrong thing. And so that have these kinds of more exploratory, fun experiences where you can be encouraged to learn is really great.
And I also don't speak it, but I certainly have heard recordings of people speaking it and elders telling stories in it. It's a beautiful language. It has a music to it and it's just a really important part of our cultural responsibility to keep the languages of the world from going extinct. There are stories that don't mean or sound the same if they aren't told in their original tongue. There are patterns of experiencing the world that somehow are matched to the linguistic structures. And it really gets us to your experience of the world we live in now, which is a colonial or post-colonial world. I would guess that somewhere in the experience of your family, residential schools may have played a part. Again, those people who aren't in Canada, it was a more than a century-long project of assimilation that involved separating children from their families, putting them in residential schools where they were often brutally and horribly mistreated. Many of them died. Terrible, traumatic experiences that people from the many Indigenous nations of Canada still suffer from, and it haunts them. And did that curse visit your family?
Yeah, it was. So the North was colonized a little later than the rest of Canada. So the residential school systems started in the 1800s in Canada, late 1800s, but really only reached the Arctic in the early 50s. And so my father and his sisters were all, essentially, they were raised living nomadically, born living nomadically on the land, certainly trading with like people, the Hudson's Bay Company, that sort of thing. But people were living outside of communities, meaning within bands, very similarly to the way they would have been for thousands of years. And then he was brought to the community that was created of Iglulik. And so some of these communities have been Inuit settlements and places of trading and resident, these kind of community day schools were built within these communities. And that was where children were brought. The one in Iglulik still exists. It's now the hotel. I stayed there. And it's just two trailers that were essentially put together. And so the one wing of it was the boys and the other was the girls. And so when my father was 8 years old, he was brought there and he was separated from his sisters. And of course, his parents were still living on the land. And then he and his sisters were then brought to Churchill, where they went to the residential school there. And eventually my grandparents moved from the land into Iglulik and essentially to be closer to their children. And that's how a lot of these communities were created. And so, at these schools, Inuktitut wasn't encouraged and actually was forbidden. And you were punished if you spoke Inuktitut or practiced any kind of your cultural traditions, and certain belief systems were replaced by Christianity and things like shamanism and any kind of belief systems that fell within that, or things that even didn't, whether it's traditional tattoos or drums or things like that. All of that was rebranded as devil worship and Satanism. And so it created this, for this generation, essentially an incredible amount of shame in these cultural practices.
It's something that, along with many other issues that have to be addressed and much more seriously addressed, frankly, at the political and the social level, you can't undo the damage that was done, but at least to begin to come to terms with it and give Indigenous communities the respect, the nation-to-nation relationship with Canada that they need to move forward and escape this multi-generational trauma. I don't want to turn it into too much of a socio-political statement, but I actually have something that kind of, in a way, we live in a Canada today that was very diverse, especially younger generations are extremely accepting of difference of all kinds. And I think that for people under, let's say, 40, to understand what the spirit of colonialism was like that motivated this, that pervaded society, I came across an interesting little marker of that myself at a used book sale. I'll hold it up. I don't know if you can see it, but it is the Ontario Reader. This was given to school children throughout Ontario. It was sold by the T. Eaton Company for 14 cents. This is the 1925 edition. And the introduction and inside, of course, the goal of all good upper Canadians was to be more British than the British. So inside the book, there is the Union Jack. Yeah. And the little introduction, which is by the Governor General of Canada, is something that I think really, first of all, I hope it doesn't make you cringe too much, but it actually, I think, can help people to understand how and in what zeitgeist these horrible things were comprehensible or seemed permissible. So this is the introduction. It's from the Governor General of Canada, and it reads as follows. Empire Day. I want you to remember what Empire Day means. Empire Day is the festival on which every British subject should reverently remember that the British Empire stands out before the whole world as the fearless champion of freedom, fair play, and equal rights, that its watchwords are responsibility, duty, sympathy, and self-sacrifice, and that a special responsibility rests with you individually to be true to the traditions and to the mission of your race. I also want you to remember that one day Canada will become, if her people are faithful to their high British traditions, the most powerful of all the self-governing nations, not excluding the people of the United Kingdom, which make up the British Empire, and that it rests with each one of you individually to do your utmost by your own conduct and example to make Canada not only the most powerful, but the noblest of all the self-governing nations that are proud to owe allegiance to the King, Earl Grey, Governor General of Canada. So with that kind of mindset being drummed into the minds of little children, this kind of assimilationist spirit is not only understandable, but also it seemed like it was inevitably part of the training. And I think it's something that Canada needs to struggle with and understand that there are still elements of this toxicity that we have to purge from our systems. And I think that your work as an artist can actually play a role in that.
It's definitely interesting to read that. And then also, of course, the language that was written just to create the residential schools, which was, the goal was to take the Indian out of the child. And in this case, it's this idea that British is better, and this idea that the Indigenous people will be better off if they are made to be more British, or that's white supremacist thought, essentially. And yeah, it is a difficult kind of thing, I think, for a lot of people to acknowledge. It is something that does just carry on into a lot of, even just our institutions, this idea that Indigenous people need your help, and that maybe that non-Indigenous people have an idea of how Indigenous people can be helped.
Right.
And just an extension of this. And even in just like more innocuous scenarios, like I was working with Google and some friends of mine in Berlin who are technologists, and Google had these kind of neat technology that was a little bit difficult to figure out. And so they weren't really sure what to do with it. So they were just inviting people like us to play around with it and shoot stuff using these cameras. And these are cameras that are essentially shooting 180 degrees, not 360 degrees. So it's essentially supposed to be like these mini IMAX, like personalized IMAX experiences. And so when we were planning on going to Nunavut and doing these workshops and how to use these cameras and then just shoot stuff. And then my partners in Germany, they reached out and were like, actually, because we're going up twice, maybe the first time we should go up and teach the Indigenous people how to use our 2D cameras, because we already know how to use those. And then we can be filming and figuring out how to use the Google cameras so that the next time we come back, we can be teaching them how to use that once we fully understand it. And then I just was like, wait a minute, but this is like a very unique opportunity where the people that have experience with or that have access to technology and Indigenous people can actually be on the same exact playing field of when it comes to knowledge, and for everybody to not know how the heck to use these cameras, it really does make it so that everybody is just as much an expert as anyone else. But this idea that, oh, as outsiders going into an Indigenous community, we must come with knowledge to share is just this.
Rather than saying, as visitors, we have knowledge to gain, which is probably a more appropriate way. But it actually does raise an interesting question, which is, I think, a very encouraging movement of a growing movement of solidarity among Indigenous people beyond the largely European defined geographical boundaries or national boundaries.
Yeah, there is a very kind of connected Indigenous community that exists outside of Canada. Certainly with my experience working with the Imaginative Institute in Toronto, which is a Imaginative Film Festival, is this amazing film festival that happens every October. They've recently become an institute with year-round programming. And at that festival, I've had the opportunity to meet Indigenous people from New Zealand, Australia, South America, and of course, circumpolar regions. And it really has, between that and then also different kinds of programs in New Zealand and in Norway is also another place where there's lots of stuff happening. Yeah, there's like this kind of great international Indigenous community, and it is wonderful to see the shared experience and the shared kind of struggle, but also what we can be learning from each other. The Australian Film Commission put together this really great pathways and protocols on how to engage with Indigenous people when you're a film producer or a filmmaker. And Canada has translated that to Canadian version. And also just actually with the NFB, I've had the opportunity to work alongside Black Americans from the American South and to see, again, these like shared frustrations, shared challenges when it comes to telling our own stories and the erasure of our identity and culture. And there's Black filmmakers that have been kind of having these conversations for just longer than the Indigenous film community has necessarily been doing this stuff. So there's things like the Afrofuturism movement, which is this is wonderful kind of little niche genre that certainly influences some of the stuff that I do, but also just this kind of Indigenous futurisms movement. And these kinds of conversations about representation and authentic representation and what it means to communities is it really is something that women can understand, queer communities can understand. It is something that a lot of people are going through. And so for us to be having these conversations and seeing the similarities amongst us all is a nice change, I think.
Right, exactly. And even though we've got a long way to go, there are hopeful signs here in Canada. There are new forums for, you know, people to tell their stories and create. And I think a growing receptivity on the parts of non-Indigenous audiences to really want to explore and want to welcome them into their own imaginative landscape. I don't know yet that can be said specifically for Indigenous people in the United States. I hope it will come, but my sense is that there's still a farther way to go there
the division in the United States is, we can feel it here, we can feel the effects of it here and how it influences our politics, of course. And yeah, I think the Indigenous communities within the United States are, it's not talked about the same kind of way as it is in Canada for sure. And there's also a different kind of way of when it comes to art and representation, those kinds of things are really, we mentioned, really valuable to communities. And we are lucky in Canada that there is public funding available for artists and creators to be making this stuff, and that we recognize that diverse voices are in need of some extra support. I sit on the board of Ontario Creates as well, which is a media organization in Canada that essentially processes tax credits, but also distributes funds to the arts as well. And just being a part of those conversations of representation and how can we support the BIPOC community in the creation of work that feels like it is true to them and that they have full kind of like ownership of is something that I'm very grateful to be, you know, that we are able to have in Canada, and that there's a recognition for the value of those resources and that they are essential.
And how? I absolutely couldn't agree more. Some of your work in that context is connected to Afrofuturism and imagines what Canada would be like in the future if the Europeans had never arrived here. Am I right about that?
Yeah, there was this kind of, so Jesse Wente is all around media guy. He is a producer. He hosts a radio show on CBC, and he was the director of the TIFF Bell Lightbox, the director of programming. And that's the kind of the year-round programming at the Lightbox in Toronto. And in 2017, which was the 150th anniversary of the creation of Canada, and the government had funds to support projects that kind of celebrated this. And having a conversation with Jesse about it, and along with some folks at Imaginative, it just felt a little uncomfortable to be celebrating this, you know, 150 years of colonization. So we wanted to do something that kind of acknowledged this kind of moment, but then also acknowledged that in 2017, that the Indigenous perspective was still very alive and well. We chose different artists, and so some of them were filmmakers, but they had all worked in media before, and essentially I helped them make the project was called 2167, and it was imagining Canada 150 years in the future. Mm-hmm. And so some people imagine these dystopian kind of societies, others took it into, what would it mean if in this world colonization didn't exist? And it's, just exploring those ideas through a uniquely Indigenous lens.
That's great. It's funny. It reminds me in a strange way of an opera by the Russian composer Rimsky-Korsakov. It's not a well-known opera, but it's called The Invisible City of Kitej. Kitej was a holy city, and it was threatened with destruction by invading hordes. But a spell was cast over the city and made it invisible. So the hordes just went right by it and never saw it, and so it was preserved.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
It's an amazing opera. For people who like opera, check it out sometime. The music is incredible. It's long, 5.5 hours long. I attended a performance in Russia, and it was 5.25 hours long, and I spoke to the conductor afterwards, and he apologized for performing the version with cuts.
Oh my gosh.
But that having been said, there's actually there's a character who lives in the woods and talks to animals, and they're her friends, and she is kind of the spiritual guide through the piece. It's quite lovely. Anyway, on to imagining the future. Where do you see yourself? Slashback has been released now. It's finished. It's a huge success. You know, what are you thinking about for upcoming work and where you imagine yourself 3, 5, 10, 15 years down the road?
During this kind of pandemic and also all of the political stuff that was going on in the States at the same time was an interesting time for me. So my co-writer on Slashback, Ryan Cavan, we had this other idea for another kind of horror project. We just in the past few days have finished the first draft for that, and we're feeling pretty good about it. So that's been nice to have something to be working on. We obviously still have to go and finish Slashback, but it's nice to feel like I've got something to get going next. I'm really just exploring right now more of a fiction kind of space. And ever since, obviously, I had this kind of crazy health thing, one of the things for me that kind of came out of it was just to make sure that if I'm going to be doing something, that I just really have to be passionate about it and be really excited about it. And within that, I'm open to really anything. So movies, of course, I kind of love. I love TV and podcasts and video games. The great thing about working within all these different spaces is that sometimes I might have even just this community of Pang, where I've now got a couple of different projects, including the Marvel superhero Snow Garb. She's from Pang as well. It's just become this like almost in a little fictional place in my head where I can populate stories.
You could be creating your whole new a whole new genre, Pang Gothic or Pang Noir. Yeah, but you mentioned Marvel, and I want to highlight the fact that you are the co-creator of a Marvel superhero.
So the indie kind of video game scene and the indie comic book scene in Toronto all blends together. And I just knew some different folks in comic books. And one of my friends, Hope Nicholson, who had actually edited a collection of comics that were the first ever female superhero was named Nelvana of the Northern Lights. She actually came out a few months before Wonder Woman. And she herself was from the Arctic. And so I'd known that this kind of collection of comics was being republished, and that's how I got connected to Jim, who is just this fantastic comic book writer who has written for, his comic Alpha Flight is very popular. He was writing for Champions, which is essentially the like a teen league for Marvel. And it's usually he had permission to use characters that already existed within the Marvel universe. So a teen Vision, Miles Morales, different kind of characters that were part of this Champions League. But it just came about that maybe there might be a chance to just pitch a new character. And so Jim just asked if I would be interested in exploring that. And so we just put together a bunch of ideas of the superpowers and things like that. Were actually, I was doing a lot of research for this kind of interactive project that was exploring the idea of shamanism. And so shamanism is the traditional belief system of Inuit. And my great grandfather is a shaman in the community of Iglulik. And so I was curious of, and the community of Iglulik in the 1920s, it was the explorer Knud Rasmussen came to Iglulik. And so there's journals about his time there, photographs and things like that. And it's really amazing that there was quite a few shaman that lived in this community. And hearing about those experiences, and as a fan of Star Wars growing up, again, total nerd, I was really drawn to this idea of Sila, which is this, essentially this like life force that connects all living things, not dissimilar to the actual force in Star Wars. And so but the shaman essentially have the ability to control to some degree this Sila. And so just exploring those ideas of what that meant, and then also just the loss of that at some point, it was just something that I was in that space already. And so then talking to Jim, it was what if some of these powers that might normally be associated with shamanism or control of Sila are something that this teenager who lives in Pang and is just a normal teen and then is surprised to discover almost these shamanistic abilities. And so that's where it drew from. And then I've got a sister-in-law who's from Pang, so I'm like sending a lot of photos of her, and I'm also getting her to just get photos of the school. And because this character is a teenager, she goes to the local high school. Mm-hmm. I didn't know at the time that I would be living in the high school. To film a movie. The way comic books come together is very different than any other kind of medium I've ever worked with. It is a very tiny team and actually very little kind of oversight from the publishers. Like our editor was really great, but just approved things. Like we just had to send things in. And so there was a lot of freedom within that. And the artist that we worked with for the series is based in South Africa. So we're doing all of this kind of remotely. Mm-hmm. And they had it. So there's Jim and I would write the script. And then there's the artist that worked in South Africa, and the artist would work with a colorist who adds the colors and things like that. So it is like a small team, but a couple of people doing their own thing, like specialized things, but it's still very contained. And it was really funny on the very first issue where Snowguard is featured, there's this like big landscape shot and these like it's snowy and there's these little rocks on the but the colorist thought they were trees. Uh-huh. And put in trees there in the Arctic. Okay. And then it was like this last minute change to get these adjusted, but it's those kinds of things were really funny.
Okay, Marvel, I know a brilliant young filmmaker. She's just about to finish her first smash hit indie horror film. And if you've got about $120 million budget for a super epic set in the North, she's got filming experience there. Long live Snowguard. You know, let's see the Snowguard movie.
Yeah, Snowguard movie, something. I don't know. It was really great to have. When that came out, there was a teacher actually at the Pang grade school that got in touch with me because he had bought some copies of the book and of the comic and had brought it to his students. And they had written me letters basically asking questions about Snowguard and things like, does she know how to ride a snowmobile and things like that. It was just like so amazing for me to see and for people to really be invested in somebody. But of course it was because she was from there and she looked like them. And it was, so it was that kind of thing was really rewarding. And yeah, I think that there could be a Snowguard thing for sure. Everything also is all I feel like the whole superhero thing is a little overpopulated at the moment. But
no, believe me, they're insatiable. And there isn't a snow guard. And the fact that she draws some of her origins back to Nelvana, of course, they didn't have issues of getting the colors wrong with Nelvana because she didn't have any ink colors.
Yeah.
During the war when they couldn't afford ink for Canadian comics, so everything was just black and white.
And that's the that's the reason why she came to exist at all, is because because the Canadians had to take up mantle during the war.
Yep, our own 5-year industry in comics. Anyway, listen, you've been very generous with your time. I just want to ask a couple of other questions. We first met because when you were at Pingwalk, you were interested in doing a 360 Glenn Gould experience. And I just wondered how you developed that interest or that idea came to you, and whether anything about him or his work speaks to you. And then finally, as you probably know, he was a nocturnal guy. He probably would have felt right at home in the Arctic Circle during the winter because he never had to deal with daylight, would never have had to deal with daylight. So he was noted for having very long nocturnal conversations, sometimes starting at 3 or 4 in the morning. If you had been the recipient of one of those calls, what would you have liked to have spoken with him about?
So I did grow up playing piano and listening to Gould's recordings. And my dad did specifically point out his recordings to me and tell me to listen quietly, kind of hear his bop, bop, bop as he's playing. And it just was, to me, I found that it was just like, it was really great to see this kind of eccentric personality playing piano. And certainly when I was growing up, I played piano and did the Royal Conservatory thing. And I remember sometimes getting some comments about taking some liberties with how I was interpreting some pieces of music. And then seeing him really going against the grain a little bit and being a little bit disruptive was nice to see. But yeah, I've also just been fascinated about even just the way he combines music and technology and all of those things. One of the things that I find interesting, and you mentioned he might like the Arctic for its lack of light. And I think he did have some kind of these like romantic ideas about what the Arctic meant, and these ideas of isolation and solitude. And just from my experience, and even just when I go home, and this, you really can't escape all of the family and friends, and everybody is just wanting to know what's going on and what's in your business. And so when I think about the Arctic, I think about community. And so I feel like in a way Gould would have been miserable perhaps. But I think that kind of conversation is also really important, and one that, you know, even with when I think about his radio documentary Idea of North that was produced, I think with the NFB or was it CBC, was this really the use of, I think he called it contrapuntal radio, the layering of interviews, and that was just done so brilliantly, and this layering of sound and treating sound like a piece of music, and these interviews as pieces of music with crescendos and things like that. But then also for the kind of layers of audio to make sense contextually within everything is so amazing. But it's, to me, just such an interesting kind of time to think about. And that we've talked about the 150th anniversary of Canada, but that was made on the 100th anniversary of Canada, the creation of Canada as a country. And he recorded these interviews on this train from Winnipeg to Churchill. And from what I understand, it was this newly built train, and this kind of represented the kind of the colonization of the Arctic. And these voices of people that are on their way up there. And it actually is one nice to listen to now if you're listening, because the ideas about the Arctic that some of these people are expressing are actually quite wonderful, or their intentions on going up. And it does, I think, give an important kind of context to these conversations. And then also for me, it's 1967, I think. My dad was 12 years old in 1967, and he was in Churchill at the residential school. And so his kind of idea of Canada and what that means to him, and the 100th anniversary of the creation of Canada for him in that moment was something that was very different. And I think that in 2020, these more than ever, it's like these are the kind of conversations we have to be having about just trying to understand each other, right, and where the other person is coming from.
And in fact, one of the things that's very striking today, there are elements of real beauty and poetry and certainly a kind of a romanticized vision. And Gould himself says in his preface that he's viewing the North as an outsider with his own romanticized vision. But 50% at least, viewed from the perspective of today, of what should be there is missing, which of course is the Indigenous voices. And that reflection led to the discussion that we've been having and have been having with the Winnipeg Art Gallery of how to essentially restore the balance and create some kind of a meeting place for the Inuit experience in the art and the culture, and then the settler vision that Gould had, and somehow find a point of both meeting and reconciliation. So, of course, we've been talking about developing a really, I think, very exciting and visionary project with you in the artistic lead of it.
Yeah, it is a little bit in the early stages. I mentioned that my great grandfather was a shaman in the North, and I was aware of that. There was a photograph I had of him, and he was wearing this coat, and it's a very kind of distinctive looking sealskin and caribou jacket. And it's got handprints on the chest, and then there's an Inukshuk in the middle of on the pendant. So when I visited the Winnipeg Art Gallery, I walked in, and in right away in their Inuit art section on this pedestal, beautifully lit, was this coat, and it was called the Shaman's Coat, and it was the one that belonged to my great great grandfather, and I was just so curious about how it ended up there. And it turns out it's actually a replica. And I think it was a family member that made the replica, but I was really curious about, you know, how it got there, but then also how we think about what is art, and this jacket that belonged to my great grandfather is like a piece of art that belongs in a museum. And also just like what, in terms of why they have it versus why family doesn't have it. But it's, mm-hmm. And when I was there, the WAG was very, and always has been, open to me asking those questions. And the other thing that in the past few years, the Winnipeg Art Gallery has done that I think is really fantastic is that they've hired full-time Inuit curators. And I think that's really important when, you know, they've housed the largest collection of Inuit art in the world. And that's because there's no place to house it in the Arctic. And until there's a place that actually can hold these pieces of artwork in Nunavut, basically they're on loan to the WAG and the National Gallery, and to take care of and to do with as they see fit. And so for the WAG to hire Inuit curators, I think was really fantastic, because it just recognizes that when you're putting together an Inuit art exhibit, if it's not curated by Inuit, then it's not really an Inuit art exhibit. And I think those are the kinds of ways that, you know, we can bridge some of these institutions with communities that might have had difficult relationships with having access to some of these spaces traditionally.
Yeah. I know that this is a project that has a lot of promise, even though it's in the early stages. We've been thinking about it for about 3 years now. I think it's incumbent on us now to join with the WAG and find this meeting place between Sila and all of the creative work that you've been planning on for the project, including augmented reality and the use of contemporary Inuit visual art, along with some elements of Glenn Gould's idea of North. And it's now just a question of a lot of planning, a lot of hard work, and funders. Do I hear any funders who want to help us make this project a reality? It could be one of the most interesting explorations of this meeting place yet conceived. And I'm hoping that it will actually not only travel across Canada, but all over the world. This is actually a nice place, I think, to bring our conversation to a close. It's actually a great moment. Just coincidentally, we scheduled this conversation a while ago, but as Nyla, just last week, we convened the jury for the Glenn Gould Prize, and we had amazing artists from all over the world. Our chair was Laurie Anderson, and we had Harry Gregson-Williams, who composes blockbuster music for blockbuster films, and A.R. Rahman and in Chennai, India, and Neil Gaiman from the Isle of Skye, and all sorts of amazing people, Hilary Hahn from Cambridge, Massachusetts, and many others. Visit our website. You can find out about that. But they considered some of the world's greatest artists and chose as our newest laureate the amazing Abenaki filmmaker Alanis Obomsawan. And we contacted her while she was in the middle of her 54th film, which she's working on at the age of 88. She's a visual artist, and she's also an incredible musician. And so I think that this is just a great moment for another sort of thread of that bringing together of cultures and hopefully reconciliation more in reality than just in symbolism in the future.
I think our jury was fantastic this year and just did a wonderful job selecting the recipient. And Alanis is truly such a kind-hearted person and just looks at the world in such a beautiful way. And the way she expresses herself and how she feels about kind and how she processes the world around her it's just wonderful that it's being recognized. And I think especially her work when it comes to the crisis in Ganawage and things like that, her work surrounding what's some referred to as the Oka crisis, was just really powerful work about the community at that time. And these same kind of fights are still going on, and these tensions amongst our Indigenous communities and non-Indigenous Canadians. And to have this beautiful and sympathetic lens to look through all of this kind of political drama is really wonderful.
Yeah, I certainly experienced this enormous kind heart, largeness of soul and spirit. And frankly, based on some of the things that she's experienced in her life, her people and the people that she's chronicled in her films, it would be completely understandable if she weren't that way, if she were bitter and angry. But I think that hopefully the spirit of love will build and breed more love in return, and we can find a way of making that the bridge that brings us all together.
Exactly.
Well, Nyla, thank you so much for being with us today. I love it. I love talking to you. We've talked about so many things in the past, the history of sound recording and all sorts of interesting ideas. And you are a limitless resource in terms of talent. So I know that the future is bright in terms of what you're going to create and bring to the world. And I guess, again, since you are a board member, how did I do, boss? Was it softball enough?
This is great. It's wonderful. We have these conversations all the time, kind of discussing just ideas. So to make it official and put it into a podcast is nice.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it. And folks, please do like, share, and subscribe. Please consider making a donation to the Glenn Gould Foundation. We're a registered charity here in Canada, and we need your support because, let's face it, the pandemic hasn't done any of us any favors. So if you can find it in your hearts to make a gift, we would not only love you for it, but we would also love to issue you a tax receipt.
I've been looking for ghosts. Woman I can love the most.
Hey, Brian, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Did you enjoy that little profile of Nyla Inuksuk?
I really did. Nyla is, for those of you who don't know, Nyla is a member of our board of directors at the Glenn Gould Foundation. So I've had a couple of conversations with her, and she is just so bright and lovely. So it was really interesting to hear about her work more in depth.
Yep, I know that she's headed up now. She's finished her quarantine, and she's finishing up her debut feature film, Slashback, in Nunavut. So everyone, we did a little geography lesson of the Great White North. Get your atlases out, or Google Maps if you prefer, and take a look at the terrain and the huge expanse that she is working in these very tiny communities way, way up north.
Yeah, it is. It's truly an incredible landscape. Must be pretty crazy to be working up in it, hey?
Yeah, I would say the challenges and the number of things they have to bring with them, pretty mind-boggling. A major, major feat for a first-time feature filmmaker.
Yeah, it is a harsh terrain, but it is just breathtakingly beautiful at the same time.
Yep, it truly is. Let's hope that it stays that way, all those of you who care about climate change and preserving our planet. We owe it to ourselves, to the animals and the fish, but also to the people who live up there.
Of course.
Anyway, let us now make our escape with a little bit of that good old-fashioned, completely mechanical, anti-technological traveling music, courtesy of Mr. Edison and his miracle cylinder machine.
It's the way we like to do it.
Excellent.